Hello everyone, my name is Crystal Hicks.
And my name is Lucy Malarkey.
And we're from WISH, which is womeninsocialhousing.org, and you're listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast.
This is a podcast where we delve deeper into stories from inspirational women who work in the social housing sector, to understand the barriers that they've overcome, to be inspired by their journeys, and to learn from their experiences. And we'll of course be asking the big question, if they had one wish, what would it be and why? Hello everyone and welcome to the If I Had One Wish podcast. My name is Lucy Malarkey and I'm joined by my co-host who is...
Crystal Hicks.
Hello, Crystal. And we are absolutely delighted today in this episode to be chatting to Evie Copeland. Evie is a housing superstar, a multi-award-winning housing evangelist who, within her relatively short career so far, has had a massive impact on the sector. And we just know that this is going to grow and her influence is just going to continue. So Evie is the Director of Customer and Communities at Berwickshire Housing Association. She sat on both the UK board and the Scotland board of the Chartered Institute of Housing in the past. She shared speaking panels with the likes of Alison Inman, and she's just completing her Master's in Housing Studies. Evie is one of the founders of the Chartered Institute of Housing, CIH Housing Futures, and all of this before she's even 35. Thank you, Evie, so much for joining us today.
Thank you. What an introduction.
So where we like to start, Evie, is sort of at the beginning, if you like, because as the song says, that's a very good place to start. So can you just tell us, please, a bit about your career journey, you know, how you got into housing and what you brought you into the sector?
Sure. Start in housing was very much, I always will forever see myself as a kid in my council estate. That's probably one of my defining features about why I decided to come and work in housing. But in terms of life events, the biggest thing ever to happen to me up until I was about 15 was getting decanted from our council house to get major works in our home. And after that, housing was never really on my agenda at all. But like on reflection, the impact that that had on my life and the life of the rest of my family was absolutely huge. I went off to university, I went to study to be a journalist and never really, as I say, thought about it again. Coming up to graduation time, there was a job in the comms team of the big local RSL that was formerly the council post-stock transfer. And the rest, as I say, is history. I started in the comms team there in 2011 and I've just done a host of other jobs since then. But I think it's always something that you hear, certainly conferences and people talking to why they decide to work in housing or why they decide to stay, that you find your home. A particular type of person when you want to do something good for the world, good for the people around about you. And I spent the first 10 years of my working life working in my hometown, serving people who lived around about me, friends, family, neighbours. And I can honestly say there's never been a greater honour or privilege to work for the people who, you know, grew up and lived around about me and were raising families and trying to live their lives in a really special part of the world for me. So working in housing, I think, allows you to do so much. But I think place was such a big part for me as well, and that part of kind of bigger identity. And then making the decision to leave Dumfries and Galloway was a huge one. I went to work for the Scottish Housing Regulator, and really that was about safeguarding the interests of tenants at a national scale. But I think for me, civil service life wasn't for me. I really missed working with real people. I was going to say human beings, but that's maybe a bit savage to poor civil servants. But
just a bit.
Community aspects and actually being able to just go out and see people sometimes as you can often in a housing role. And an opportunity came up at BHA to join their new customer experience team in 2022. And I've been there ever since.
Brilliant. So I think comms, I mean, it's not an area I've ever worked in, but I imagine it's one that you really get a feel for service delivery, what we are doing well and what we're not doing so well as well, because obviously that's where a lot of the issues, the reactive issues, definitely come from, don't they? So you didn't mean to get into housing, but that's where you've ended up, and your values have really kept you there.
For sure. And I think the thing about the comms job, everybody will have the experience of different types of comms people, but I think for me it was really getting into the the mechanics of how all these services run and what we might need to talk to tenants about, what we might need to talk to wider residents about, what some of that wider stakeholder piece with elected members, for example, and funders, regulators, all that other stuff, members even for companies and societies. What are all the things that we do? How do we tell people about it? And I think the story, certainly now, if I even look back even 5 years, the way that we talk about what we do as a sector feels entirely different, much more kind of reflective, much more honest, perhaps. And I often use the phrase to my colleagues that you have people in the world that look out the window or people that look out the mirror. And I think now we've become a sector that's spending much more time looking in the mirror to get to the heart of what some of our root cause issues are, so that we can work together with all these other partners and, of course, the people that we exist to provide homes for together to get an even better story to come.
It's really interesting, isn't it, Evie? I think like the world of comms used to be around sort of, oh, well, it sits in your marketing and comms team and it's about getting messages out there to people. But I think the sector's sort of realising that actually comms is a two-way thing. So your communication strategy isn't about what do we want to tell our tenants. It's actually much more now, or is moving towards being, well, what do we need to hear from our tenants? What are we not hearing?
Definitely. And when you think, like, there is the big thing in the sector at the moment around customer and tenant voice. Organisations like TPAS, for example, have existed doing excellent work for years and years. But I guess the thing that's made that more interesting over the last few years is what would, in a comms world, 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, be more like user-generated content. So the likes of Wajo, for example, who started out with an iPhone, going and checking in on some of these problems and showing them to the world. If you look at other sectors, that would be the equivalent of an influencer sitting down to do a haul, or that they've had a huge package of stuff from a brand, but perhaps reviewing that a bit more honestly than, this is amazing what I've got from whoever, actually, this is what you need to watch out for. And I think for me, this is much more about roots and connection and making sure people are getting exactly what they're entitled to, being able to exercise their rights appropriately, support to do that. And Crystal, like, I have the most admiration for you and the work that you do with Crisis and Partners Shelter, some of these big organisations that are trying to tackle this huge systemic issue that has plagued the UK and beyond the world for years and years, and it's not getting any better. But it is, little bits.
I love that sort of idea of social housing influencers. I think that's, yeah, that's brilliant to look at it through that lens.
But I guess the sad bit of it is there's people paid a lot of money to protect the interests of the folk that are paying their wages, and to have somebody outside showing some of the cracks and things that are going wrong actually is a whole different conversation, actually.
Yeah,
it is. And I think I'm going to take us down another track, if you don't mind, Evie. Because one of the things we're really enthusiastic about at Wish is mentorship, and that the influence that mentoring relationships can have on women's careers. And you've spoken quite frequently about mentorship and the positive influence that women have had upon your life. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about sort of some of the impact that mentoring has had on maybe your choices and career development and sort of lessons, I suppose.
Sure. I think the first thing I would say is you maybe don't see the women, certainly, and I think for me it definitely has been 95% women in my life that have helped shape what I want to do and what I do next, how I take the steps in between one point to another. But that's not to say it's exclusively, because there's been one exceptional man who has helped me massively in my career, and I feel like if I don't shout out Dan Blake, that would be criminal to not say that. But in terms of the women, I've been very lucky to work with strong, very experienced, very dedicated women. And I think for me, that's shaped a lot of my own work ethic, but also the way that, you know, I want to help an organisation be part of leadership structures to be able to share what I've received from others to the people I work with now. I think the first one was Jane Moore. Jane Moore was the director of housing at Dumfries and Galloway Housing Partnership. I worked for Jane for 10 years. And I think for me, Jane took me from a comms person, a journalism graduate, somebody that had every intention of going out to save the world with my words, into somebody that actually coached Jim Strang. You can do more for somebody in one day as a housing professional than many careers can dream to do in a lifetime. So I think the relationship I had with Jane, she was somebody that had come from Dumfries and Galloway, worked in a very much frontline role, worked up the ladder, and was leaving this huge body of people to do great things in a place that, as I said already, really meant the world, means the world to me. And I think for that, she was very much a CIH advocate. That's a really big and important part of what I do. But she also was very good at paying it forward. So she never had recognition, if you like. We touched on some awards. She encouraged me to go for that. And the first thing she encouraged me to do was, in fact, she didn't even encourage me. She did it behind my back. She put me up for an award in Scotland. And it's this one. It was the Bob Allen Young Achiever in Housing Excellence.
Snappy title.
At the time. It's not called that now. Snappy. But actually, the critical thing about that for me was heritage. So Bob Allen was the guy that's responsible for the Glasgow stock transfer.
Okay.
Very much tenants at the heart of what he's doing, what he did. He's sadly no longer with us, but actually, for some, maybe the title of Young Achiever meant something, but actually to have something for me, to have something in the name of Bob Allen, that somebody even for a minute thought anything I'd done was worthy of that name, was massive. Hmm. And from there, she really helped me. If you want to do this, if you want to have the impact that you so clearly desire to do, you need to begin to build a name, a brand. All those other things that actually for a comms person is quite easy to do. Next step was Inside Housing, Rising Stars. Did that, first person in Scotland to ever do it. Great. Again, having to build a story about who you are, why you do it, why it's important, how you can encourage other people to do it. And hugely supportive that I am going to help you get there, which was great. Now, the next person I think who has helped shape for me is Alison Inman. And Alison came into my life at the end of Rising Stars. I'd done a huge bit of work alongside other colleagues from across the whole of the UK in this competition, which ended up then certainly in a public vote. So I had all the Celtic nations behind me. This is it. Everybody talking. You're going to win. You're going to win. You're going to win. And I didn't win. And I just remember feeling so low. And then this ball of energy in the form of Alison Inman came into my life and was like, hey, listen, it's fine. There's other things that we can do. And you can't let this stop you doing anything else. And she introduced me to Ellie Ho, and we set up CIH Futures alongside 14 other people from across the whole of the UK, which now, again, is probably one of my proudest things that I've done in the whole time I've worked in the sector, because that's still, to this day, 3 or 4 evolutions on, is still delivering for young professionals in the sector, which is brilliant. And I think things change. Pandemics happened. People's priorities are slightly different. Jane retired, effectively. And I was looking for another job. I started with the SHR, and then there was a chance to go and work with Michelle Meldrum, who is a North East powerhouse like yourselves. And again, just the potential and the support that this other woman has brought into my life to support me, I think that for me has let me see that's safe, that's acceptable, that you can do all the things you want to do and be somebody who helps other people quite easily. And I think really for me, all of them share really great examples of how to role model, how to be the change that you want to see, how to take a bit of a specialism and actually use that to an advantage to create some real change. And I think Michelle is the most recent example. Our work on domestic abuse, for example, in the Northeast and beyond, has really changed things for services and just the way that people access things, particularly in housing. But even things like shining a light on the fact that the Make a Stand campaign from 2019, actually people signed up to it, but maybe didn't bring the energy and the kind of the completeness that required to time. So that's come back through as a sector issue that organisations are having to realign themselves to the commitments they already made. And to be able to do that at a national level by having that influence, but also being someone who's supportive and open and welcoming, bring others into that conversation and lead in that way, I think that's the greatest lesson that's really difficult to put into 10 or 20 words.
Evie, you've name dropped some of the women that we're hoping to have on the podcast actually in the next few series, Alison and Ellie. And you know, I think there are so many inspiring women, aren't there, in the sector who have given their time to mentor younger women, younger professionals and colleagues coming through. I suppose just picking out from what you said, if there was someone listening to this podcast and they thought, actually, you know what, I probably could do with getting a mentor, and where Evie was maybe 10, 15 years ago, and it sounds like that would work for me. What advice would you give them about like how to go about doing that? How did you find your mentors?
I think that's probably the difficult thing, because it might not always be someone who you have to enter into a formal process with. So I think probably the first thing is, who is round about you? Who could help you? Who's already helping you? But I think you need to be really clear about what your ask is, because you may almost by stealth be kind of someone else living vicariously through you. They didn't have that right, but you could do that. Let me help you do this. Be really clear about what you want and what you want to get out of any relationship. I think things like, if you were a CIH member, you can access mentoring through that platform. Attending things like WISH events in your locality, you'll meet some of these brilliant women who 9 times out of 10 won't think they've got anything they can offer you, and they can offer you wonderful things in spades. But I think if you're not clear about what you would need from that relationship, that makes it really difficult to ask of somebody else. And I think the other bit is really, you might not need to have the formal sign up of you're a mentor. Actually, some of this might be a friend who's maybe 10, 15, 20 years just ahead of you, or has walked that path or a similar path in front of you, that if nothing else, you can bounce things off of, and you may consider them a mentor, or they may consider they're mentoring you. Some of this comes from quite an organic place, I think, as well, but probably what we're missing collectively is a way of directing people into some of these opportunities that some will walk into and they'll fall into their lap, and others, you know, might struggle, particularly if you're a bit of a one-off where you're working, if nobody's having that sort of conversation. So things like WISH and things like CIH become even more important to get into that conversation or network with people who are like-minded.
Yeah, I think that's so very true, isn't it? You can adopt a structured approach, but sometimes it is very organic. And the mentoring, I think, is an amazing thing. I think often, like you say, people do it without realizing that they are, but they are that active role model that's providing so much to those around them. I just really would like to just go back slightly and ask you a little bit more about CIH Futures, because like you said there, you know, it's something you're really proud of, that achievement of setting up CIH Futures, and absolutely you should be. Tell us a little bit more about what it's at and what it does, what it's doing.
Sure, yeah. We set up in 2018 as a body, a forum to represent housing professionals under 40. The first big target we kind of had our sights on was getting a concessional membership rate. So anybody, regardless of age, regardless of role, regardless of point in your career, was paying the same as somebody who may have been in a senior position at the different levels of CIH membership. So that was the first big success, was to get a kind of under 30s rate that was far more accessible. £5 a month, it was a marketer's dream. We had every bit of £5 branding. Cheaper than a coffee, cheaper than Netflix at the time, for people to join this network. So representation from across the UK. And part of that was about making the CIH membership offer more accessible to young professionals, making events more accessible to young professionals. But I think the biggest bit of work we did really was, at the time, CIH were still in partnership with the kind of big housing event in Manchester. So development of the Fringe, conference sessions, very much specific to people new to the sector, people young in the sector, alongside a social, which provided that kind of introductory. This is another network of people who are in a similar position, events alongside that, and just hosting space for young professionals to come together who may have come from other sectors, who may be coming out the workplace for the first time, who might be returning to work after having a baby or another family crisis or care requirement of responsibilities of whatever variety, to come back into the sector and actually have that welcoming space that's very specific, because there are some others that exist around that. But to do that in a way that encourages housing as a career to school-aged people, that makes sure the CIH membership offers really relevant to young professionals and flexes and works to the needs of young professionals, that is a kind of branch at each level of the UK. So there's Scotland, there's Northern Ireland, there's Wales, there's the English team as well. And then this kind of centralised hub that covers the interests of all young professionals across the whole of the UK. And I think even things like the Welsh team in the past have done some really brilliant research work on what frontline professionals are experiencing, even during the pandemic, what symptoms of burnout, that kind of thing. So there's a wellbeing thing here. There's also, if you're really ambitious and you want to progress, what are some of the opportunities available to you? But ultimately, making sure people are making the most of their membership.
That all sounds brilliant. Absolutely does. And, you know, being far too old to be a member of that, I think it's something I would have really valued, you know, at the start of my career. You know, I started working in housing age 22, and, you know, I really would have found that useful, because there wasn't that network. You know, you were lucky if you came across people like you of a similar age group. Yeah, good luck rather than anything to really help you with that.
Definitely. I think the other bit is like things like day release, for example, to go and do your qualification just doesn't exist in the same way anymore. So some of these things are almost a bit of a 2020 translation of what we have had in the past and what's worked in the past into something a bit more fit for now and in the future.
Talking about the future, Evie, can we ask you to get your crystal ball out, please? No, it would be really interesting, I think, to hear where you think we are going. You know, what's the future look like for the sector and for you, Evie, as well? You know, you've achieved so much, as I said right at the start, you know, but you're still so young. But where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? And what's the rest of the sector going to look like by then?
I often wonder where I'll be in 10 years' time. I often wonder where I'll be in 2 years' time. And I think the pace of change now and the world that we're trying to operate in and do all the things that providers are trying to do and the wider sector, it's no wonder people get exhausted. And I think if I can continue to encourage people around me and myself to just take some time, we're never going to make anything different or better if the cup is empty ourselves. So I think that first and foremost, I think for the long-term future, all I ever wanted to be when I first started was a housing association chief exec. I think that's a very different ask now than even when I started in the sector. And I almost have a bit of an eye on, was there something political in my future? That impact perhaps is maybe not something I want to achieve in one specific place. How can I make that bigger? And I think it's just it's a question of some of the policy pieces that we need to sort out, and even the differences between Scotland and England. I think I'm now, for the first time in my life, a resident in the Northeast, which is straight, just even seeing some of the different dynamics for what's literally 10 miles away in Scotland is, yeah, a challenge. So even getting people to, especially in the part of the UK that I'm working in just now, even getting people over that slight border to understand the differences, I think there's a lot of probably comms work, actually. Everything comes back to the story and how we tell people and what we share and how we talk to some of the things that we do. So there's a bit of that work. I think the sector and the future, who knows? I think the pressures on local authorities, social services, other support, the NHS, community psychiatric services, all that myriad of other things that we need as housing people to keep things turning and moving. Again, it's just becoming more pressured than ever. So we need a new solution to what living and thriving in communities actually looks like. And that takes input from everybody. I think the other bit for the sector, one of my other sort of sidelines is community-led housing. I think the other thing we need to really start seriously talking about is a mixed approach to the housing emergency. Social housing will be the big player in this, absolutely. Nobody's disputing that for a second. Our empty buildings, our disused buildings, our second homes, how we use some of that other property to create options and opportunities for people, even property guardianship for person-led temporary accommodation as opposed to a statutory thing. I think we need to start having a much more focused, frank and direct conversation about what some of these other parts of a solution might look like. And perhaps in 10 years, that might be something that's happening a bit more regularly without a few people banging drums about it.
I'll tell you what, I've got every confidence that within 10 years, you'll have banged that drum and change will have happened, Evie. I love that we need a new solution. And I think that's so right, isn't it? You know, and there is a big role for comms in this about how we describe that story, like you said, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, that old adage that if we keep on doing all the stuff that we did to get us here, we're never going to find the solutions we need to get us where we need to be.
Definitely. And I think, Alison, if we keep plugging her, that might guilt her into saying yes quickly. She's one that we've tried all of this for 20, 30 and 40 years and it's not solved the problem. So we need to start doing something differently and it's up to you to solve it. So there's definitely something. But again, I don't think we're often grateful enough for all the academics that do work in the housing space and the work that happens alongside practitioners to try and come up with some different approaches. And the work that we do infiltrates into so many aspects of life. So supply and keeping people with roofs over their heads, only a big part of what we're trying to do, but only one.
Evie, you and I are of a similar generation. I think we probably, you know, grew up through the same decades, shall I say. And I think that question around sort of what does the next 10 years look like for you was quite a challenging one for people our age to answer. Because I don't know how you feel, but I was always told you can be whatever you want to be, you can do whatever you want to do, and you can do something for 5 years and then go and do something totally different. And I think we're sort of seeing that, aren't we, with the younger generation coming up, that you know, they're going to maybe have 3 or 4 careers in their lifetime. And that's a shift change, isn't it? From, you know, how things maybe have been in the past where you go into a sector and you stay there forever. Now it's, you know, I'm onto my second career. No doubt I'll have another one before I pack up. You know, I think that just keeping that open mind around what the future looks like is just part of our generation, isn't it?
Exactly. And taking the experience you've got from something and taking it into something else. Because you think about women like Carla Keegans, another Northeast woman who did the local authority things, housing management, and then set up this social enterprise to bring empty homes back into use through an ethical lettings agency. And people like Susan Actimel in Scotland, Homes for Good, growing that to provide a different effect. Private waiting offer alongside things like everybody else, RSLs, social housing providers alongside that. So just, I guess it's about taking the good stuff and creating alongside it. Because even, I don't know about you guys, but you talk to people who are like starting businesses and startups, and you know, there's lots of startups going around even on the kind of peripherals of the housing sector. And I don't remember that ever being like that, that people were stopping what would have been always a bit of a proper job to go and throw themselves into something else. And actually, I think what you've said, Crystal, there about the purpose-driven next generation, like the power that's coming and the mindset shift about what they should be focusing on. And actually that short-termism and the pace that some of the startups change and can develop and bring something in and implement. We're seeing that even in things like the way the housing associations, for example, even deal with things like their core housing systems, the way that's changed. So maybe just opening our eyes to what's happening round about us on a bigger scale rather than the things that just scratch our back, if you like.
Yeah, I think you're right. Keeping your eyes wide open because you know, there's more to the whole of housing than just social housing. I think that's a real key point that I'm going to take away from our conversation today. I think that's so very, very true. So, Evie, thank you so much. We've come to our last question that we'd like to ask you, and it's the question that we ask all of our guests. The final question is, if you had one wish, and we're going to be strict, only one, Evie, for the sector, what would it be and why?
Meet our targets for new home delivery. In fact, no, exceed our target for the building of new homes. And I think that would solve a lot of things. So I don't think we'd need to ask for anything else. We can get the graft on to sort anything else.
Absolutely. A woman working in homelessness, Evie, I'll say amen to that. Look, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast. Next time, we'll be talking to another inspirational female from the housing sector who will be sharing her career story